From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Santa Clara.
I'm from Fremont.
Pacifica, California.
Pleasanton.
I'm from Vallejo.
Me from Enya.
Bay Area cities, including Oakland and San Jose, are battling rising crime rates. But up in Richmond, a new approach to combating violence is yielding results.
We are engaging both sides of different conflicts and formalizing peace treaties between warring factions.
How the city of Richmond cut its murder rate. Then we'll look at whether those lessons can be applied to Oakland.
When their complaints are being seen as taken seriously, that's when the residents and the citizens of Oakland will have more confidence in the department.
And we'll conclude our series, The Money Diaries, with reflections on what it means to grow up.
Most people think of it as, oh, you know, you're getting money, but it came at a cost.
The costs of change today on Cross Currents. Residents in the city of Richmond are reeling from a recent shooting spree, which included the murder of a 19-year-old man. The city has had four homicides so far this year, all committed in public, all during the day. And there have even been other daytime shootings. They've shocked city residents because crimes like that are no longer the norm. It may be hard to believe, but many Richmond residents now talk about rampant gun violence as a thing of the past. Less than a decade ago, the city experienced the chaos of a violent crime wave. There were 47 murders in 2009. For a city of its size, just over 100,000 people, that was almost 10 times the national average.
In 2009, I lost a whole line of friends, like, just back to back.
Jamika Henderson was a sophomore at Richmond High back then.
It was like killings every single day. And that's basically it, like, just losing my friends and having to go to thousands of funerals within 2 days.
Do you remember, can you give a number of, like, 5 friends, 20 friends, or?
I can say that will come at the top of my head right now. I can, like, literally close to, like, 10, maybe 10.
Including her best friend.
So he's, like, the other half of me. Like, I was the quiet part, and he was, like, the loud, funny part. And when we got together, we was just as one. And I don't know, we just had this bond that was unbreakable until... Well, it's not even broke now. I still have a bond with him.
But after 2009, the number of murders dropped dramatically to 18 in 2012. So how has this historically crime-ridden city been able to slow down the violence? KLW's Kyungjin Lee went to Richmond to find out.
For the past 7 years, Richard Boyd has lived in Richmond's Iron Triangle neighborhood, an area with a historic reputation of violence. He says the block feels completely different from when he first got there.
My neighbor said to me the other day, she said, I haven't sat on my porch in 30 years. This is the first time in 30 years. This is when we've got it cleaned up initially. And now people don't mind if their kids are walking to the store. And the kids are outside now and they're playing soccer in the parking lot. And they're not walking past drug dealers when they get up at 7 o'clock in the morning to go to school.
We're outside his front door on McDonald Avenue and First Street. For years after he moved in, he had to deal with criminal elements on his block.
Daily. I mean, literally daily. It was either the domestic violence, either the gunshot, either the stabbing, either the two guys fist fighting, either the man and wife yelling and screaming at each other. It was something all the time. It was rarely nothing.
Violent crime got so bad in the mid-2000s that the city council considered declaring a state of emergency, which would have brought assistance from other enforcement agencies on California's dime. Some residents demanded help from the National Guard. Back then, no one knew what to do about the rampant crime rate, says Kimberly Acevis, co-director of the Rise Youth Center. She says young people felt a sense of hopelessness and everyone knew something had to change.
In the pauses between the spikes in violence, there was a new conversation about how do we get innovative, how do we listen to young people, how do we involve residents in the solutions.
She says a new generation of leaders began to take shape. Faith-based groups expanded their service to formerly incarcerated people. And a new city manager and police chief came on board.
Well, Richmond has had a lot of long-term challenges related to crime in general, and certainly violent crime specifically.
Since Chris Magnus started as chief 7 years ago, he's determined that hardcore violence stems from a relatively small group of people. He says now his department is focused on around 30 individuals at any given time.
It's not about just stopping everybody who might be out on the street corner or assuming that everybody who lives in a particular neighborhood is engaged in violent crime. It's about doing the background research and analysis to figure out who really is engaged in some of this.
It's made a difference. Between 2006 and 2012, overall crime rates dropped more than 20%. The murder rate fell by 60%. The police force is bigger now than when Magnus took the helm. But, he says, it's just as important how those cops work in the community.
It's broken. Great.
That bike is really big for him.
He's riding it, though.
I know he is. He needs a helmet. We should have brought one.
Do we have any?
I recently spent a day with a couple of Richmond police officers. We patrolled the central district of the city, a traditionally working-class neighborhood with families from diverse backgrounds, but mostly Latino and African-American.
You got a sticker?
Yeah, we got a sticker for you.
Come on, me.
You want a sticker?
I don't have a sticker.
I need my cousin one.
You need a sticker?
Mm-hmm.
How about a coloring book, too?
Huh?
You like to color?
Yeah.
The officers are usually on bikes, riding down the alleys and other hot spots where crime usually happens. But today, we're in a patrol car. Magnus says they practice proactive policing, which means...
You have to get out of your car. That's first and foremost a big part of it. You have to be at neighborhood meetings. You have to be consistently at neighborhood meetings. And you have to realize that you have a responsibility for that just as much as you do for responding to 911 calls, writing traffic tickets, making arrests. You have to see that as part of your job.
He also says the police department couldn't possibly control the crime by itself.
We have a good partner in City Hall as well through the Office of Neighborhood Safety.
Despite Richmond's history of bitter political conflict between progressives and conservatives, city leaders worked together to establish the Office of Neighborhood Safety, or ONS, in 2007. It was the first government-run agency in the state solely established to prevent gun violence. I'm at the ONS office in Richmond City Hall. Kevin McCullough is a neighborhood change agent, or a street outreach worker. He's talking with a group of ambassadors, or participants who successfully completed a one-year fellowship program. They now help mentor the next generation of the city's most violent young men.
It was tough. I was at my mama's house on the floor with a blanket that was too short to cover my shoulders and my feet at the same time. That was my real life.
I'm not talking about at-risk kids.
Devone Bogan is the director of ONS.
I'm talking about young men who for 16, 17, in some cases, 20 years have been exposed to the trauma of gun violence. And as a result of that exposure, have become significant perpetrators of gun violence.
Participants are identified through street and police intelligence. They're taught life and conflict management skills, as well as educational and employment training opportunities. McCullough is helping three young men plan their immediate futures. He checks in with Rashid Shepherd, who's interested in becoming a merchant seaman. Shepherd's been involved with ONS for 3 years.
How much is it to buy into a haul, Rashid?
They got the $8,000, $5,000. Like, it's different hauls.
Where the paperwork at for that, Rashid?
I've been on the line. I can show you all in my email.
I want you to show me in the email. I want you to print it out.
I'll print it out.
And I want you to bring it to me.
But I didn't did that before.
No, you haven't. Not to pay for no haul, because we would have been paid for a haul.
Director Devone Bogan says instead of waiting for participants to seek help, the outreach workers go out directly to where the issues are.
We are engaging both sides of different conflicts every day that are going on. It's akin to street parenting. Each one of our neighborhood change agents would consider themselves, if not a surrogate parent, to each of these young men.
This kind of engagement by the ONS, along with police, community, and faith-based efforts has paid off. In 2011, Richmond fell off the 10th position on the FBI's list of most dangerous cities in the U.S. It had made the notorious top 10 list 3 times in the past 5 years. Despite the safer environment, says RISE Youth Center Director Kimberly Aceves, young people still deal with violence every day.
Homicides are down, but it doesn't mean there are less guns on the street or young people aren't being impacted. I feel like it is still a condition that they are having to deal with daily. I think poverty is a really big piece of that.
Indeed. Richmond's per capita income in the 2010 census was just shy of $28,000 a year. That's over $10,000 less than nearby Berkeley or San Francisco. The poverty is even worse in the Iron Triangle, but it doesn't get residents like Richard Boyd down. When he moved to town, he looked to clean up his neighborhood. He eventually became a professional organizer, and now he works with a local faith-based nonprofit that supports working-class families.
I think that I'm glad that I live here. I think that I've never lived in a more warmer place in all of my life, but I've never lived in, the fact that I'm going to land here forever, this is where we decided that we're gonna die in this place, I'm real grateful we did it.
In Richmond, I'm Kyungjin Lee for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And reporter Kyungjin Lee joins me now in studio to talk more about the crime drop in Richmond and what other cities can learn from Richmond's approach. So, Kyungjin, we heard that there was a shooting in Richmond last week, plus a fourth death at the Richmond BART station. So how do those numbers fit into what's going on with Richmond overall this year?
Well, it's the community is taking this very seriously. The police department is taking this very seriously. Chief Chris Magnus sent out a 850-word memo last week to city leaders and community leaders about trying to get this under control. But when we take the overall violence rate trend into context, it is similar to the rate that we have been seeing in the last couple of years. It's actually getting a little bit better. So specifically in 2012, at this time last year, they had 7 murders. In 2011, they had 5. So the city as a whole is getting much better at curbing the rate of violent crimes.
Mm-hmm. The murder rate is definitely still falling in Richmond.
Yes.
Despite this last kind of shooting spree.
Absolutely.
So we also want to look at what's happening in Oakland, which is a city similar to Richmond in terms of its crime and violent crime in particular. Oakland is really struggling with a spike in murder rate right now. So how do you compare what's happening in Oakland with the story that you just told us about being able to combat a lot of the violence in Richmond?
So there are a lot of similarities between these two communities. Richmond really saw a drastic spike in the violent crime rate back in the mid-2000s. It came to a boiling point where people were beside themselves. The city leaders, and community members were like, what can we do about this? It's out of control. Something different has to happen. So there was new leadership that was brought into the city through the manager and the chief of police, and the community really got behind them. We see something similar happening in Oakland currently. You know, after many years of crime decreasing in Oakland, 2012 was the first year that we saw a big dramatic spike with regards to murders and burglary rates. And so we see something similar within the city leadership, within community leadership, and community members all saying, what can we do?
This is a crisis. And so, but what Oakland is also concurrently grappling with is that their police force has been repeatedly cut. What's happening there?
So, yeah, there's a 25% decrease in the Oakland Police Department, whereas Richmond really beefed up its police department by 25%. So that's a huge difference right there. As we all know, Oakland's been dealing with the budget crisis in the city for many years. So that, I mean, it's still a process in flux, right? We still don't really know what's happening.
And Oakland is also dealing with the fact that it's under a federal court order to change, to reform its police department. So how is that whole reorganization happening?
So Chief Howard Jordan is still the chief of police. He still has a day-to-day operational. He's still the commander of the day-to-day operations at the police department. He's still commanding his top commanders and working with the city administrator and the mayor and the city council to, you know, run the police department. However, he does have to work in consultation cooperatively with these two outside monitors that have been appointed by the judge that is overseeing the writer's lawsuit and the settlement.
And that's the 2003 writer's settlement, which put Oakland Police Department under threat of federal receivership.
That's correct. So we have an independent monitoring team that's been in place since the conclusion of the settlement in 2003 to keep track of how the department has progressed on the reforms that it has promised to make. Now we have a new compliance director who's come in recently because they have not been able to make the reforms in such a timely manner that people had hoped. So this person is really in charge of making sure these reforms really happen in a timely manner in the next, you know, as quickly as possible.
So what kinds of reforms do you think that people will see or need to see in order to feel like this is there are actual changes and maybe Oakland Police Department can get out from under this federal receivership and people really start to see changes in community police relations?
So there's a few different things that the police department still needs to tackle in their list of reforms, but a few key things include still the big ticket items, police accountability and transparency with regards to its internal investigation. So for example, the department was supposed to set up a computerized system to keep track of potential problematic officers. They still don't have that system up yet. Additionally, they were supposed to reform or speed up the internal investigations process, the complaint process, to have a timely resolution. And it still takes over a year for many of the complaints to go through the investigation process. So when citizens can see their complaints resolved in a timely manner, when there is an actual decrease in crime, especially in violent crimes with the murder rates, the robbery rates, that's when the relationship between the community and the police will have made a tangible difference. And when the residents can have an interaction with the police that's not negative, that they don't feel like they're being harassed, when their complaints are being seen as taken seriously, that's when the residents and the citizens of Oakland will have more confidence in the department.
Kyunjin Lee is KALW's criminal justice reporter. And if you'd like to tell us how your city is tackling crime or let us know what you think of Oakland or Richmond's response, you can give us a call at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. Or if you have a story idea for us, you can call that same number and let us know. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We'll end today's show with the last piece in our series, The Money Diaries, which features young people from Oakland talking about their relationships with money. Today, we'll meet Jabari Omari, who's a high school senior. For Jabari, leaving high school comes with an emotional burden few young people have to face. His mother died after a stroke several years ago. In her will, she left him insurance money, but he can't access it until he's 21. So until then, he's applying for college scholarships and trying to figure out how to become an adult on his own.
Hey, it's Jabari Omari, and it is Thursday at 5:06. Just up, getting ready for school. Close to 6. I'm just here scrambling. Update my iPod. Find a song that I want to listen to. So pretty much how I start my day.
To what we're talking about.
No time for drama, we got a message.
We're letting out.
You won't see how the father, we gotta show you how. Let go of all the things that's holding you down.
I live in San Leandro with my brother. He is 25. He does act like a parent figure to me. He stepped in when he needed to, and I appreciated that. Well, I live in San Leandro, but I go to school in Oakland. I have to commute to school for about 2.5 hours on bus just to get there on time. So, close to the last 2 months of my freshman year, my mother passed away. I was devastated. I was hurt. I wasn't really able to believe what was going on at the time. I had dreams leading up to that. I had nightmares of her being harmed, and I felt that that was a way that God was letting me know I need to become closer to my mother. I found out the hard way what those dreams meant. My mother is no longer here with me. That, you know, this is your time to grow up and learn how to be independent and not be attached, because I was a mama's boy. I was in so much pain. I mean, you know, you feel alone. Even though people have your back, they care for you, they look out for you. Just to wake up and never see her again, or only see her in your dreams, or look at a picture, it hurts. It hurts so much. In her will that my mother left, she said that the insurance money would go to me. And for me to get this money, it's, most people think of it as, oh, you know, you're getting money, go ahead and spend it, but also save it. But I don't think of it as a really good thing to be happy about, because it came at a cost. For me to get this insurance money, it cost me my mother. And most people say, you know, don't feel that way. But I would not be getting this money if she was still alive. I would still have her presence, her smile, and her love. I don't have the same look on how everything is anymore. Yeah, I've been trying to financially support myself so I can do great things. I'm recently going to graduate soon, and you know, I have to ask my brother, can he pay for my cap and gown, my tassel, and senior pictures, senior class ring, and, like, senior trip, and all these expenses? I feel like I'm freeloading when I should be playing my part. Even though I haven't been 18 for a while, I just know that it comes with challenges. But personally, I would like to choose to stand on my own 2 feet and be a man about my business and just, you know, live life the way my mother would have wanted me to live it. Not cradled up and bitter and sad all the time, but grown up, mature, working, living on my own, and making my other siblings and family proud.
The Money Diary series is produced by Lisa Morehouse and the Game Theory Academy, which is a financial education program for young adults. For links to the other pieces in this series, go to our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KLW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Laura Flynn, Stephen Short, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, Eva Sonsan, Raisu Sussman, Brooke Welty, and Mary Willis. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And also thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And a special thanks to you. Yes, you. If you are listening, we are local, independent, listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing is from the trio Manning, Cass, and Darter. These local musicians are noted performers on their own, and they combine their talents in this group to create something new, something they call chamber music for the new century. They'll be performing this coming Saturday at Studio 55 in San Rafael starting at 8 p.m. And if you're looking for something to make you laugh this week, look no further than the Marsh Theater in San Francisco, where tomorrow night local comedian Will Durst will debut his new one-man show.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a few words in defense of one of the most maligned groups in America today, the rich. Isn't it about time we stopped demonizing the wealthy just because they have a couple of more bucks than we do? Besides, we all know money can't buy happiness. Although, admittedly, it can be used as barter for a lot of stuff that might make you happy, like food and shelter and healthcare.
That's comedian Will Durst. His new one-man show opens tomorrow night at the Marsh. You can find details online at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.